The Jews are very demanding people.
Yes, we are.
You know, like when Moses splits the Red Sea and they're standing there watching the sea actually split in front of their eyes, and he turns around and he says, "What do you mean it's a bit muddy?"
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And today we celebrate our 50th recording, a momentous occasion, our Golden Jubilee. When the Queen celebrates a Jubilee, it's often marked by congratulations from foreign dignitaries, renaming of landmarks in her honour, and street parties across the country. But here, as it's Worst Foot Forward, we prefer to commemorate our Pyrite, or Fool's Golden Jubilee. So, we intend to spend the day tweeting cat gifs at the Prime Minister of New Zealand, graffitiing Worst Foot Wazir on our local Tesco, and stopping traffic on the Finchley Road with an impromptu and very much not officially licensed parade of schoolchildren wearing massive papier-mâché heads with our faces on. And with me, as ever, on this hastily conceived anniversary, is the petrol station bought flowers to my £10 iTunes voucher. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello.
You alright?
Yeah, mate.
Happy anniversary.
Hey. We did it.
We've made, guys, this is it. Everything's fixed now.
Yeah.
We've made 50 of these. The world's a better place, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Nothing else happened in 2017 worth mentioning.
I mean, yeah, I do worry that since we started making this podcast, the world has got progressively worse to try and just go, we need to feed them more material.
Do you feel like we're opening a series of Pandora's boxes?
Or what?
Pandora's Russian dolls.
Yeah, Pandora's Babushka dolls.
Yeah.
Well, it's like a few years ago, started recording a Newcastle United podcast and had to stop because all the way through down to the second division and we're sort of shitting that for the first few games. So I'm worried that we're having that effect on the world as well.
So you say we should stop?
Well, it's, yeah, mate, we're in the tradition
of... I mean, we've got a guest here and everything. It would be, he's come quite a long way.
Oh, that is true. It would be, that would be a very bad way to start an episode.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Cue the theme music.
Since you mentioned him, we should introduce our guest.
Yeah.
So, today's guest is a postdoctorate research fellow at the University of Haifa in Israel. He was a fellow at Rutgers University and Notre Dame University. He also has a PhD in metaphysics from the University of London. Since graduating, he has written papers including titles such as Bertrand Russell and the Nature of Propositions, Is There a Primordial Torah, and Kurt Vonnegut and the Creator of the Universe. Added to his ridiculous list of garlands and medals, he is also an ordained rabbi and has studied at various yeshivas. And most importantly, he's a mate of mine that I grew up with and haven't seen for about a decade. And he has travelled all the way from Israel to be here today, thus having the longest commute of any guest on this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Sam Liebens.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me on your 50th anniversary and your last episode.
Yeah.
just for those of you wondering, by the way, those book titles, I mean, Sam is quite funny as well. You might think, I'm not sure about the Bertrand Russell and the Nature
Russell
Proposition.
And Nature Propositions. That's not
a laugh a minute.
They tried to sack him from, and they actually succeeded in sacking him from an appointment at the City University of New York for moral depravity. And the story goes, I'm not sure if it's true, but it does sum up his sense of humour. The story goes that they said, how can you teach our children ethics when you're so unethical? And he says, well, for years I've been teaching geometry and I'm not a triangle.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
That's a good line. I wouldn't open with it, but good line.
But so I wrote a book on Bertrand Russell, but it wasn't. It's not a laugh a minute, I have to say. But there's this website. It's called the Ig Nobel, right?
Yeah.
It's like the opposite of the Nobel Awards for really stupid research and research that's not useful and research that I got an honorary mention on their website.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
That is an amazing achievement.
That's the goal of this podcast.
Well, exactly. It's like the worst academic.
That's why we set our eyes.
Yeah, the way you describe like the children with papier-mâché heads, I imagine like an Olympic opening ceremony that is clearly how they start the Ig Nobel Award.
Right. Yes.
Just loads of...
they forgot to put eye holes on them. Yeah. bashing into each other.
I wrote a journal article called Would This Paper Exist If I Hadn't Written It? And that's what got the honourable mention.
I think the Guardian readers in the podcast community have just all orgasmed.
We do like to ask guests what their worst art in the world.
Probably DIY would rank highly among the things that I'm worst at.
Have you ever injured yourself doing DIY?
No, because I believe to do that, you'd have to start by doing some DIY.
Is this one of the things where you, like a child says, I don't like mushrooms?
Yeah, I basically decided I'm not good at it.
Right.
Yeah, I may be fabulous at it, actually.
That's always a possibility.
Yes.
What I wanted to know about it is that, so my memory of going to Jewish Sunday school is that there's always a prayer or a blessing for everything. And there's always a ruling for everything.
Yes.
Like if you want to know, it's like things like kosher laws aren't just about food; they're about how you live your life in every way. So, can one do kosher DIY?
I have to think. There's not like a blessing to say before one does one's DIY.
I just wonder if a religious Jewish man,
you have to build it in a certain order. That would be such a Jewish thing, wouldn't it? It'd be like there's a whole town. Oh, you're making a table. Oh, there's a Talmud. There's a tractate table, and you have to start with the right leg and then with the left leg, and then you make a benediction and you put a screw in the right leg, and then
make it sound like the rules of golf. Like there's the rules of golf, and then there's another book which is called Decisions on the Rules of Golf.
Oh,
which
right.
is like 5 times longer than the rules of golf, where everyone goes, now in the case of a ball landing on someone's hat in a water hazard, what's the ruling for that? And it gives like examples of where this is.
I can't remember his name, but I saw a Jewish comic doing this thing about, isn't it lucky we don't have Christmas trees on Hanukkah, because there would be a whole tractate about how to decorate it, what you're supposed to have in mind when you decorate it, the degrees that it should be leaning to the left, the degrees it should be. So I could so imagine that, but no. I think the rabbis would generally not good enough at DIY to legislate much about it.
No, I've just got an image in my head of a rabbi who's accidentally nailed his beard to the wall.
Well, it would
sort
be
screwed in his hair.
Screwed in his hair.
Wouldn't be the first rabbi nailed to something.
No.
Today we are going to be talking about the world's worst messiah. Yes. Which is, when that came, Ben was doing all the ins and outs and organising this, and when he said, that's the final topic, I sort of ripped my shirt off, did a lap of honour around the room. I was so excited. It won't be a whole hour about the life of Brian, though, I'm sure. Ben, you're going to start us off, aren't you?
Yes, mate. So I feel, as a representative of the city of Newcastle upon Tyne, there is only one place we can start.
Yeah.
And that is Kevin Keegan.
Right.
Because Kevin Keegan was heralded as the Geordie Messiah.
He's quite an ecumenical figure, though, because he did play for Liverpool quite successfully, too. So it's like he crossed into other religions.
Yeah, well, and as a playmaker, he was very good at crosses, which is often quite important for a messiah. And the thing is...
They were very interested in whether Jesus could cross. That was one of the big things between... Yeah. The Pharisees weren't impressed with his...
No. Yeah, well, the thing is that Jesus...
He was very one-footed. That was Jesus.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, he wasn't an outfield player. He played in goal because Jesus saves.
Yes. He's associated with the cross.
But the problem was he always fielded a couple of men too many.
Yeah. is that not an advantage you get if you're playing for God's team? It's like, no, we play with 12.
Yeah.
It's like it's a Christian's 11.
The 12th man, literal 12th man.
It's like a baker's dozen. A Messiah's 11.
That's what I'm getting at.
Sorry, but you were saying Kevin Keegan is the Geordie Messiah. Was supposed to be.
He was meant to be. Like, when Kevin Keegan took over Newcastle in 1992, we were at the bottom of the second division. We were going to get relegated to the third tier of English football for the first time in our entire history.
And then Ben stopped doing his podcast. Yeah. The age of 9.
Yeah. And in the Premiership now.
Well, no, the podcast was just me stood on a hill in Gosforth with a megaphone. but the thing is, like all good messiahs, he started well. I was going to ask you in a minute about what makes a messiah, but I think you've got to return people to the promised land. Tick, did that.
Because right, what was the promised land? What, the championship?
The promised the land of the Premier division. League, yeah, the yeah, first division. Yeah. But then I suppose to bring, well, I guess the bringing of revelation. I think yes. you could say he brought revelation in the style
in
of
what way?
In the form of Andy Cole.
In the form of Andy Cole, yes.
He revealed Andy Cole to the public.
Yeah, yes. exactly. Yes. I mean, I think that the bigger revelation was Philippe Albert.
That's true. no one saw that coming.
He brought us, no one expects Philippe Albert.
And you want that from a messiah.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately I get a form of heaven on earth, really, which is where it all falls down, because we didn't fucking win anything.
Are you saying that Stan Collymore is Pontius Pilate in this analogy?
Yeah, we have lost so many listeners. Really.
That's a very strong analogy for the football fans.
Yes, it is a strong analogy.
Not anybody else. They're like, why are we getting on to the religion stuff? We were waiting for some cracking more Bertrand Russell anecdotes.
This is a funny thing. You see, if a messiah really does everything you want a messiah to do, it might just be like kind of the end of the world, and there'll be nothing more to it. And it's kind of a bit of an anticlimax. Like, oh, it was really as good as it was supposed to be.
So you're saying that a good messiah should leave us wanting more?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
No one to get off.
Yeah, no one to get off. And Jesus, you know, and Jesus' disciples were a bit confused in the beginning about the fact that he hadn't done some of the things that the messiah was supposed to do, like kind of end war and hunger and disease and stuff. Because there does still seem to be some of that around.
If you go looking, everyone's a bloody critic.
Yeah, you can still find
the sort of the big central messiah stuff's in Isaiah, isn't it?
Yeah, you see, he had a proper Jesuit education. They love the book of Isaiah.
Yeah, really? That's the big one where they have, he'll be of the line of King David, and he'll be born in. Well, he doesn't exactly say Bethlehem, but everyone goes, okay, that means Bethlehem. I'll call my son out of Egypt, which is definitely a reference back to Moses and not forward to Jesus fleeing
but
to
still,
Egypt. But still it kind of works.
The suffering servant.
He'll suffer on behalf of humanity and redeem the world and die all that.
His name will be Jesus, he'll die on a cross. No, it doesn't. Yeah.
Well, it's basically, there's a lot of backsplanation goes into the Jesus myth. If you can take Isaiah and you can twist it enough to make it that, look, that sounds a lot like that Jesus guy.
Yeah, backsplanation, I like that.
Yeah. Obviously, the idea of a messiah in Judaism is slightly different to a Christian messiah, isn't it? Because we talk about a messianic age rather than a messianic person.
Yeah. Bringing the children of Israel back to the homeland. And
clearly, Jesus hadn't done a lot of the things that people were expecting from Messiah. And then in the Christian world, the notion of the messiah evolves to include this notion of a second coming. But the Jews certainly had, they were expecting in the first coming. The Jews are very demanding people.
Yes, they are.
You know, like when Moses splits the Red Sea and standing there watching the sea actually split in front of their eyes, and he turns around and he says, "What do you mean it's a bit muddy?" We're very demanding people. So we were expecting from the Messiah the end of war and hunger, world peace. The lion and the lamb would lie together.
Yeah, that happens in a lot of Michelin star restaurants now.
So I see. It would be
Serengeti and Turkey.
There would just be later on Jewish mystics envisage it as kind of a return to Eden. We'll be living in no poverty, no hunger, no war, no anything. The Jews will have all returned to Israel. The end of any type of exile. There'll be a third temple built and lasting, whatever. And Jesus didn't necessarily achieve all that. So the Christian world evolved a kind of different notion of the Messiah to the one that's current.
As well as which
the Jews.
Christian Messiah is definitely the Son of God, whereas
it's not clear,
Judaism is not.
So in Second Temple, in Second Temple Judaism, it looks like some Jews thought that when the Messiah come, he would be the Son of God. Mm-hmm. But then as Judaism evolved, partly in reaction to Christianity, Jews like, no, when the Messiah comes, he's just a human being.
And is it true that Judaism isn't really fussed about when Jesus arrives as well? There's a lot of the millennial Christian culture like, he's definitely arriving. Like this, he's gonna come this time, and the Jews are like, whatever.
Well, yeah,
it doesn't
matter.
He's coming whenever.
Just whatever. Yeah. But except there is this notion around the year 6000.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
in the year 2240, for those of you who are looking forward to it.
Right. So,
oh, nicely done.
Yeah,
nicely
he's got, done. Yeah, 6,000 in the Jewish calendar, so that's about the year 2240 Gregorian.
But we'll be screwed by then. He doesn't come then.
That's got the way things are going. That's a bit late.
No,
you should have paid for Messiah X.
But that's the point when the Nibiru turns up. Yeah. I'm here, guys.
Ben's right. Ben's always right, of course. But there is an opinion in the Talmud. There's an opinion in the Talmud for most things. But there's an opinion in the Talmud that says he won't even be a person. It's just an age, but a very utopic age. Mm. Jesus was that. Oh, well, maybe he wasn't. Well, he was. He definitely
was about. But
yes, yeah.
But there were lots of other wannabe Jesus's Jesus, if you like, at the same time.
Yeah, we just had loads of tribute acts.
Around. Like there were at least two other quite prominent contenders to be the Messiah at the same time as Jesus was alive.
Was it like being the heavyweight championship of the world? It was the WBC Messiah.
There wasn't a unified Messiah at the time.
Slightly after Jesus, there was this guy, Bar Kokhba. Shimon Bar Kokhba, right? Who led this rebellion against the Romans less than a century after Jesus had died, but still after Jesus. He was a much bigger deal among kind of the Palestinian Jews than the memory of Jesus was at that time, because he was leading a real rebellion against the Romans, and it looked like at one point he was going to win until they killed him and anybody who supported him.
I did a bit of reading about Shimon Bar Kokhba.
So he
was rebelling against Emperor Hadrian.
Yes.
Hadrian went, right, Jews, you're going to have to put a stop to circumcision, and they went, fuck you, we're going to do guerrilla warfare. Yes. And but there was
they really hated foreskins in Palestine.
Yeah. Yeah. Bar Kokhba allegedly built a force of about 100,000 guerrilla soldiers, and it required 12 Roman legions to go and put down.
It's why they left Britain. Rebellion. It's why they left Britain.
Yes.
The Romans left Britain to fight Bar Kokhba.
The other front,
classic, never fight a war on two fronts.
Yeah.
And the general that the Romans brought in was a guy called Julius Severus. So you know how bad it is if they're bringing in a Severus to put us down. And in the end, Jerusalem was leveled to the ground. 1,000 villages were demolished. Apparently 500,000 people died.
Eesh.
And loads of rabbis ended up being put into slavery.
Yeah.
And the article I read, the thing that it posited was going, if you look at how quickly Bar Kokhba was able to rally the Jewish troops into a really functional army, said, what if there hadn't been that rebellion?
Yeah.
And what if the Jews had just hung around, and then 150, 200 years later, Rome starts to collapse, and there's this very, very powerful Jewish...
Yeah.
I was about to say Jewish lobby, but that has a lot of connotations within Rome. But
are you saying the Jews could have controlled the world?
I am saying that we could have got there a lot fucking quicker than we have.
The way we do it now is so tenuous.
Yeah, right? It really is.
And those meetings of the Elders of Zion, I just find them boring.
They're so tedious. Yeah, so tedious.
It's so bureaucratic and less flashy than, you know, an army.
It is. It's like, you know, here's a guy, John Smith, he's a carpenter in Iowa. How are we going to pick on him? It's the details. The devil's in the details.
Yeah, it is.
Running the international Jewish conspiracy, it's harder work than people imagine. It's not as sexy.
No. The worst thing is at those meetings, right at the end, you've been there for 4 hours, and then someone says, any other business. And you know how much we love that. Yeah.
You're going to be there forever. Yeah.
I feel so privileged.
Oh shit, we've said this all in front of a Jesuit.
Oh no.
Massively devoted to the Pope. He'll be hearing about this.
But I think the Christians did something kind of clever, because when Bar Kokhba gets killed, everyone's like, oh, so he wasn't the Messiah. So it's over. And his most prominent rabbinic follower, Rabbi Akiva, says, ah, I kind of knew it all along. He didn't have... This is the words... His words were... Even though he'd followed him, his words were like... He didn't have the smell of a Messiah.
Yeah.
I don't know what that smell is. And could you bottle it? Like, you know, like Messiah by Rabbi Akiva.
Paco Rabbi Akiva.
I'd love to see those advertising hoardings of just a rabbi in wife runs with a six-pack.
Messiah.
There's a chap called Shabbatai Zevi.
Shabbatai Tzvi.
Thank you. Shabbatai Tzvi.
Yeah. That same, yeah. I think converting to Islam probably isn't a good look for a Jewish Messiah. Yeah. No offence to our Muslims.
Is that what happened to him?
Yeah, well, that's the end of his story.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. I saw the headlines on this one.
Yeah, the beginning of the story, he started signing letters. I am the Lord your God.
Yeah.
He then, and you'll have to explain this to me, Sam, he married a Torah scroll.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, he married a Torah scroll.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some deep... I mean, Shabtai Tzvi wasn't an idiot. In the Christian Trinity, the second person of the Godhead is the Logos, right? The Word of God, who becomes incarnate in Jesus. But the Word of God is also God's law. So in Second Temple Judaism, that had been the Torah, right? The eternal Torah, God's wisdom, God's law, God's whatever, that didn't ever become incarnate in a person like it did in the Christian world, but it came incarnate in this book. But it's God's daughter. And God gave the Jewish people his daughter in marriage. But he actually married a scroll to kind of signify this. In the wisdom of Solomon.
All Torah scrolls then were his wife, though?
Well, this is deeply polygamous.
Yeah. Do you think Shabtai Tzvi called up God first and asked for his blessing?
I think he kind of thought he was God. He kind of probably asked himself first.
So he married his own daughter.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah.
It gets messy.
Don't
question it, guys. I know what I'm doing.
But he had already done the other thing which messiahs are famous for doing, and he'd already married a prostitute before he married the Torah. Shabtai Tzvi married a prostitute. And it's almost like he went out looking for one. Like he went on J Date. Right, and he was like,
listeners who don't know, that's a Jewish dating app.
Yes, and there was like a one for potential Messiah's wives. They all have to be they have to be prostitutes.
Yeah,
because Jesus did that.
Yeah,
you know,
he did
marry her, and if you know, depends how Jesuit you want to be. Probably never touched her because he was above that.
When was Shabtai Tzvi alive?
17th century.
17th century. Yeah. Right, so.
But he. I mean, he was doing. He probably convinced more Jews than Jesus ever did.
But then converting to Islam did kind of. Yeah,
that put most Jews off, and they were like.
The reason he did it is because he basically planned to conquer Turkey, and he raised an army. He's going, we're going to conquer Turkey, take over Constantinople, and then the Turks went, "No, you're not, mate. And when you have a choice, death or Islam." And he went, "I'll take the Islam. Thank you very much."
Because I think the Turks were already in control of Israel.
That would make sense.
And Nathan of Gaza was his prophet.
Nathan of Gaza. Gaza. The hipster prophet.
Yeah, that's right. Nathan of Gaza was Shabtai Tzvi's prophet, and he was preparing the land of Israel for him to come. And yes, they wanted to go and get the Ottomans out of the way. And the Ottomans.
There's a lot of furniture to move.
Yeah. The Ottomans were not happy with this, and yes, they gave him the old Islam or death choice, and he chose Islam. There is a group of people who still believe in Shabtai Tzvi, and they lived as crypto-Jews, the followers of... There's still some.
Crypto-Jews is actually the name of the AI project that the Elders of Zion are designing to take over the world in 2040.
Crypto-Jews sounds like... It's a very offensive name for a band.
But I'm gonna depart the Judaic world from now and go to 16th century Europe, because if you want to find a good bad Messiah, you need to go to the world of Anabaptism, because these guys were fucking nuts. Obviously, in 1519, Martin Luther nails his 95 complaints to a door in Germany and begins...
Not just any door. The door of the Cathedral of Wittenberg.
Yes, of course.
Bedroom door.
He was just a very aggressive flyer.
To the door of a toilet, and everyone's like, "Oh, that one's occupied."
Yeah. The thing is, because Europe was in absolute uproar at this time, there was Charles V had gone all the way down from the Holy Roman Empire in Germany, and he'd taken over Rome where the Pope was. There were people who were starving. There'd been the Peasants' Revolt in 1525. So there was a real feeling that the end of the world is coming. The church has been split in two. Someone's got control of the Pope. People are hungry in the streets. And the Anabaptists were saying, here's the thing, it's not just that priests and bishops and the Pope has no authority and then you have a direct connection to God. You as an individual can interpret the Bible in your own personal way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just read it, interpret it as you want.
Yeah, but the Bible's got some pretty crazy stuff in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. So my three favourite Anabaptists, which is the sort of sentence you can only say on this podcast. Thomas Munzer, who was a gentleman who referred to Martin Luther as Dr. Liar, Father Pussyfoot, and the Wittenberg Pope.
Father Pussyfoot and the Wittenberg Popes. An amazing jazz band.
They're on the same bill as the Crypto Jews.
I don't think Pussyfoot sounded as bad as it does to our ears.
It's a very squelchy approach. Can't really sneak up behind anyone.
God. But Munzer, he would make these incredible speeches where he claimed that if the enemies attacked him, it didn't matter because he would cut their cannonballs in his sleeves.
If he could do that, I would be very impressed.
Yeah.
That's Darren Brown shit right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely is. However, obviously, he could not do this.
What do you mean, obviously? I was waiting to hear the end of the story.
Well, sadly, no one even tested the theorem.
I'm a religious person, so I'm very credulous. So
so somebody could just come along and say, you know what I can do? You know what? I can catch cannonballs in my sleeve. You go, really? You're an amazing human being.
Really? Yeah.
I do not demand any proof.
That's my basic epistemology.
Doubtless Thomas.
Yeah.
Doubtless Thomas. Believes everything. I've got stigmata. You do not need to show me. Keep your hands in your pockets.
This pussyfoot guy.
Sorry, pussyfoot guy,
He said he could catch cannonballs.
Yes.
How did he die?
He drowned in his own sleeves.
I want to tell you about Frina Bumainin. Briefly, she was in St. Gallen in Switzerland. She proclaimed herself the new Messiah, gathered disciples. However, in her delusion, she became convinced she was going to give birth to the Antichrist.
Oh, no.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah.
Do you think the Antichrist is an STI?
It's a whole new interpretation. Yeah.
My nomination for the world's first Messiah is John of Leiden.
Oh, yeah.
Or Jan Bokelson.
Yeah.
In the early 1530s, Munster, which was a town in North Germany, was taken over by a group of Anabaptists, including at their head a baker called Jan Mathis and his mate, John of Leiden. And they declared it a new Jerusalem. Few spanners in the works. Firstly, Jan Mathis kept having apocalyptic visions as part of his experience of the vision.
He would actually
strip naked and then go and sit in the middle of the town naked having visions.
Did they take over this town and did everyone just rush to his cause, or did they kick out the residents of the town?
So both.
Both.
There was already about 10% of the town was Anabaptist.
Got you.
And they did a whole convert or die, and they went, bye, see you later. And then other...
Hold on a second. They didn't say convert, leave or die.
Excuse me, sorry. Convert, leave or die.
Okay, good.
That's like snog, marry a boy.
Back in the day.
Mathis dies after a siege that the Catholics do to try and take the place back on Easter Sunday in 1534, I believe it is. And then Bokelson takes over and he goes off on one. Hmm. He describes himself as the king. He also then made himself a golden throne in the marketplace, which people had to bring gifts to. But he popped polygamy as part of the law books.
You can do that.
You can do that as the Messiah.
Yeah. And his pattern with all of these messiahs. They go, this is going to, we're going to be great. We're all going to be equal. Yeah. I want a throne and 100 wives. It's such a U-turn.
Yeah. That's, and then Luke's going, Jesus, we're just going to take that out. Yeah. A little bit of editing there. His exact wording was that any woman has to accept the first proposal that is made to her. So essentially, women were just being chased around Munster.
They all had their fingers in their ears. The girls were la 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 la.
Every time a man got down on his knees, they ran away.
Just Munster turned into a giant Benny Hill sketch.
I would watch that Benny Hill show.
So Jan Bokelson, eventually the Catholic authorities managed to get in. They took over the town. He was captured. He was stuck in a collar with an iron spike. He had red hot tongs pull his skin off. His tongue was pulled out and a burning dagger was thrust into his heart. And then him and three other Anabaptist traitors were put in cages above the town where their bones were kept there for 50 years as a reminder not to go Anabaptist. His behaviour is so baked into the Dutch way of life that there's a Dutch saying, Zich met een Jan van Leiden, which basically means to go John Leiden.
Yeah.
And you should never go John Leiden because it basically means to go mental.
Oh, I thought it meant to be like a member of a seminal rock group and then do ads for butter.
Yeah, there's that too. Yeah, that's why you should never go John Leiden.
Sorry.
I'm now kind of stuck in this philosophical quandary because I don't know what a good Messiah would be, as we've discussed. Like, there's a Jewish saying. It's one of the 13 principles of faith that I believe with perfect faith that the Messiah will come, and even though he tarries, I wait every day for his arrival. And Yeshaya Leibovitz, who was a Israeli academic, political figure, chemist, philosopher, and many other things, he was radical and he was religious in his own very distinctive way. He hated messianism. He thought messianism was a very, very dangerous force. And he said that the distinctive thing about this Jewish principle is faith is that it's written in the future tense. I believe that the Messiah will come, which means as soon as you believe the Messiah has come, you're no longer Jewish. Oh, no. you're no longer believing in Judaism. Like the Messiah is almost like, on his view, an ideal that's never reached but always aspired towards. So I don't know what the best Messiah would look like, and I don't know, you know, so I don't know. Anyway, I don't know. So,
you know, we'd have such a moral effect on you.
I'm stuck. Kevin Keegan. I like this notion of a kind of mundane Messiah.
Mm.
I saw in The Guardian a year back or something, this photographer who'd gone around the world taking photographs of Jesus's. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by that was people who thought of themselves to be Jesus. And I remember a number of them were just really quite, you know, one of them had two followers or something. Oh, it's like, that's so sweet. Bless. That's so nice. And he just was living a normal life. He was something like an accountant or a... And I kind of like that type of Messiah.
I like the idea that he doesn't believe he's the Messiah, but the two followers do. He's there trying to do a spreadsheet, and they're like, "We want to worship you." He's like, "Please, I need to get this done."
But on the spreadsheet, it's just one column is the saved, one is the unsaved.
The unsaved seems to be very long.
Yeah,
yes, just anyone who's not.
Those two people are saved to the cloud.
So I kind of like that. But there was this guy, Jacob Frank, who was a student of Shabtai Tzvi. After mm-hmm. Shabtai Tzvi had disappointed people by becoming Muslim, Jacob Frank emerged and said that he was a reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi. And he brought this idea of redeeming the darkness, going down to hell and kind of redeeming it, like Shabtai Tzvi had done.
Mm-hmm.
He brought it to a whole new level, and he said that the best way to draw close to God is through atonement and repenting. But you can't do that unless you've done some stuff that's bad. Uh-oh. So... cue orgy.
Bring me a throne and some wine.
exactly. But his sect was much more, it seemed to have been much more, they shared the fun more. It was kind of free love.
Yeah.
And they believed that it was wrong, but they believed that they had to do the sin in order to...
This reminds me of a thing. I can't remember if it's you. No, it's not you that told me. It's my friend John who I went to university with. There was a particular sect of Christians, and I think about the 17th, 18th century, that talked about you had to have Jesus in your mind at all times, but particularly when you're doing a holy act, for example, making life.
Mm-hmm.
You had to, so when you were making love to your wife, really you had to be thinking of Jesus Christ, which is already an interestingly dangerous pitch to be playing on, but said, really, what is the holiest part of Jesus Christ? It is the stigmata.
Yeah.
It is the wounds. So really, to be the holiest when you're having sex, you should imagine...
Literally the holiest.
Yeah, that you are humping the wounds of Christ.
Okay, you've now... Yeah, there may have been, like, one very devout Christian still listening to this. They have left. They just flushed them out.
Yeah.
They were like...
Now it's just us and the atheists.
There ain't nobody here but us atheists. There's no... But that's a genuine historical fact. It's a disturbing one, but this is a genuine piece of teaching that they had.
It is interesting that there is this sexual dimension to messianism.
Yeah.
Yes, but there's a sexual dimension to theism in general anyway, this notion of wanting to cleave to the transcendent other and the erotic desire for closeness to this source of life in God. So there is an eroticism anyway in religion, but then it becomes focused around the person of the Messiah.
It's almost like it's the Billy Connolly thing about anyone who says they want to be a politician should immediately be barred from doing so. Yeah. I think Lessingerism sort of similar.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Jesuses that I've that, you know, because there are different kind of reconstructions of the historical person of Jesus. The ones who I have most sympathy for really is the one who didn't have any pretensions to be a Messiah. And he wasn't known for having his gold chair and his prostitutes and his concubines and his. So actually, with all due respect to the thousands of years worth of Jewish martyrs who decided that they would rather die than convert to Christianity, and power to them, I think that they were right not to be cajoled into accepting another person's faith. Nonetheless, Jesus is a pretty good Messiah, really.
Messiahs
go, he doesn't, you know, he wasn't Jacob Frank. No. He wasn't trying to kind of have orgies, as far as we know.
As far as we know.
Yeah. And he wasn't like saying sin in order to become close to me.
And he wasn't raising an army.
No, no.
He was just like, let's be nice to each other.
Yeah, yeah, he was pretty, you know, as Messiahs go, it's just he didn't do some of the other stuff, like getting Newcastle to win the Champions League. He didn't.
Rebuilding the temple.
Rebuilding the temple.
Because he was a carpenter, you see. He wasn't a bricklayer.
I know.
Wrong profession.
Could have made a wooden temple, at least.
But then a big bad wolf would have come down and blown it.
Clearly. We need a bricklayer.
And pigs in the temple, Ben. That'd be ridiculous.
I'm sure that's a really good point.
A Messiah who's a bricklayer, that might have been more...
What, yeah. Dave?
Yeah,
Dave the Messiah.
Dave the bricklaying Messiah. This guy, this accountant that I read about with his two followers, he actually turns out to be not a bad Messiah at all. He's a pretty good one. He's like a, you know, best foot forward Messiah. Like, if you're not going to save the world and bring peace and harmony to all people and end the exile of exiled peoples and etc., the least you can do is not be a sex depraved pervert who amasses ill-gotten gains at the expense of others
and make sure that people don't evade their taxes either.
Right, exactly. Yeah, probably give solid tax advice.
Yeah, that's what every Jew wants from their Messiah.
Right. So I suppose my worst Messiah would have to be Jacob Frank, because he doesn't seem like a very nice human being.
Mm.
Yeah, but then I think...
Was he immediately after?
Pretty soon after Shabbatai Tzvi.
But
you've got, like, you have a messianism around evil. I mean, Hitler and Stalin are some pretty bad messiahs.
Gosh, I never even thought of that. And they actively cultivated messianic tropes in all of the propaganda that popped out.
Yeah, there's a cult of the personality. Yeah. The national salvation, the things that the Jewish people and the Christians and the Muslims, the Messianic Muslims, are expecting from their Messiah. Hitler and Stalin, and other totalitarians play into some of those same tropes.
But only I can fix America.
Right.
That sort of thing.
That's right. They're the saviour. They're the, you know. And so messianism is this, you can understand why Yeshayahu Leibovitch was saying, "I'd rather my I like my messiahs in the future tense."
Yeah,
right? Messianism is this very, very dangerous concept. So I suppose, you know, Jacob Frank is, I think, the closest that the Jews have had to a pure. Shabbatai Tzvi was probably close. Was probably the same, like a pure evil.
What happened to Jacob Frank in the end?
I don't know, we need to Google that.
Tortured and died?
No, he didn't have as bad a time as... He lived in the Christian West where convert or die had already gone out of fashion.
He did go to prison for 13 years, which increased his influence with the sect by surrounding him with the aura of martyrdom, according to Wikipedia here.
Yeah, martyrdom helped, yeah. Anyway, most false messiahs much prefer the aura of martyrdom to martyrdom.
Yeah, if you're going to be a false messiah, it's like, do you want to die painfully for what you believe in?
I wouldn't mind looking like I did.
Exactly,
Just one other anecdote, because we were thinking about what we talk about while we were here. Worst philosopher, because I'm a philosopher. Worst messiah, because I'm a messiah. Worst rabbi, because I'm a rabbi. And the worst rabbi that I was going to come up with, again, someone I really quite like, but he was a rabbi in the medieval times, Tosafist, a group of French rabbis, and he wrote a book called She'elot u'Tshuvot min HaShamayim, which means a responser from heaven. Rabbis would answer legal questions. Is this kosher? Is this okay? He would field legal questions. But in order to answer them, he would go to sleep. And he'd go up to heaven in his dream and he'd ask the angels what the law is. And first of all, I just find that really cool because like that, your main job is to be a rabbi, to answer questions. He did it while sleeping. And I was imagining like other jobs that you could do while asleep. Like clearly the worst bus driver, for example, would be one that slept while driving the bus. But the charming thing about his book was one of the questions he received was, are you allowed to answer legal Jewish questions from visions in a dream?
And all the Guardian readers at the time orgasmed.
so he goes to sleep and he goes up to heaven and he asks the angel that he would consult, am I allowed to make Jewish legal rulings based on our conversations? And guess what the angel says?
No.
Yes. And he goes down and he writes it and publishes the book.
First things first, I looked at Handel's Messiah. I thought it might be worth doing a little bit of... Yeah, it's a great Messiah. Yeah. First, it was an oratorio. Now, the reason he wrote... Have any of you seen Messiah performed?
No. I've actually been in the choir performing it as a Jew with my little Jew cap on.
Oh, that's nice.
Singing about Jesus.
It's great. Fun. I've seen it a couple of times. Yeah. And it's an oratorio, so it's not staged. It's just the singers at the front of the orchestra singing. He'd had a couple of sort of dodgily received operas at the time, so he's like, well, this is cheaper. I can be in control. I don't have to get in foreign stars to stage this.
Yeah.
He did it in Dublin in Fishamble Street on April the 13th, 1742. They had an audience, a record audience of 700 people because the ladies had been asked not to wear dresses with hoops so they could get more people in. So they had packed the place out.
I have to do that in my lectures.
Yeah.
I've told them no hoops.
Stop wearing bustles.
Yeah, I have a strict no hoop policy in my lectures.
Bustles are going to come back in these days. Yeah. You know it's going to happen. And the soprano was a girl called Susanna Kibber, or Chibber, C-I-B-B-E-R. And she sang the lines.
Kibber.
She sang the lines, he was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And apparently her voice was so pure and the lines were so moving that the Reverend Patrick Delaney in the audience jumped up and cried, woman, for all this be all thy sins forgiven. That she was so pure and the lines were so great. And Handel gave him... famously, it was George III stood up during a performance of him. That's why you're meant to stand at a certain part of Handel's Messiah. You mentioning the guys who like the modern messiahs who are not really very forthcoming made me think of this guy, Alvaro Theus, who's a Brazilian who in 1979 was fasting and he suddenly had some visions. You know, when your blood sugar's a bit low, stuff can happen. He suddenly realised he was Jesus. So this is nearly 40 years later, he's living in a compound just outside Brasilia in a town he calls New Jerusalem. Compound's always a worrying word when it comes to science. We're not even going to mention David Koresh today.
No one good.
You don't want to live in a compound. That's it.
Yeah,
it's either Osama bin Laden or messiahs who live in compounds these days. So this guy, Alvaro Theus, he preaches online via YouTube and Facebook Live. And he has over 330,000 followers.
Wow. Yeah.
But if you're a public figure on Facebook, what can people do? They can give you a rating.
And
this Messiah is rated 3.3 stars out of 5.
Oh, shame.
Yeah, so bless Alvaro.
He's a very average Messiah.
Yeah, but he's over halfway there.
Yeah,
to 5.
And he's living on a prayer.
Yeah.
And another more modern claimant to be in the Messiah is David Shaler. Do you remember who David Shaler is? David Shaler is the MI5 informant from the 90s.
Yes.
David Shaler was a journalist, then became an MI5 officer, and he revealed, he was a whistleblower, he went to the media and revealed that MI5 had been involved in a failed attempt to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. And since then, well, he's gone down the 9/11 truther route, he's living in a squat, He indulges in some transvestism. His alter ego is called Dolores.
That's all right.
And he claims, after a premonition he had, that when he stopped a bomb attack on a London club, that he realised he is Jesus. Mm. And he's the current embodiment of the Messiah. Previous owners of the role, according to David Shaler, include King Arthur, Mark Antony, Macbeth, Lawrence of Arabia, and Che Guevara, his immediate predecessor. And he's a big fan of David Icke as well, is David Shaler.
No, he shouldn't be, though, because isn't David Icke also Jesus?
Well, he says, David has done something
I like David, but he's wrong about the Jesus thing.
Nearly the opposite. Jesus. He says, David has done some very important work. I see him as the John the Baptist to my Christ.
Which is such a dig.
It is.
I thought we were going to say that, like, they share Jesus and sort of Jesus embodies David Icke or something.
They have 3 days a week.
Yeah,
you could do that.
There's other religions have Messiah figures as well. Rastafarianism. Do you know who the Messiah in Rastafarianism
is? Selassie.
Haile Selassie, indeed. So the reason they believe that is he's of the Solomonic line, offspring of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And she was meant to be the queen of it's probably Saba is the area in South Arabia, but just across the Red Sea is the
Ethiopia
and Eritrea and those areas. So his family dynasty, they ruled Ethiopia for 800 years. It was a really like continuous line from the 1200s onwards. When Haile Selassie visited Jamaica on the 21st of April 1966, maybe like 100,000 people came to see him because he was going to be the Messiah who would redeem the African people and the African diaspora and bring them back home to their promised land. And so 100,000 people turned out to see him smoking spliffs and hash pipes, and they rushed the tarmac when the plane landed, and it took them ages to be able to get him off the plane.
They had to get
like a Rastafarian elder to go up onto the steps and say, can everyone like just calm down, we need to get him off.
Much bigger than the Beatles.
It was huge. Amazing. And they call 21st of April is now Groundation Day. Which I don't know why it's not Groundation Day, but anyway. The second holiest day in Rastafarianism after the 2nd of November, which is his coronation day.
Was he a nice guy, Haile Selassie?
He seems he was sort of campaigning against chemical weapons. He was a big figure at the UN and travelling the world. He was quite famous. I don't know how good he was at all. He was basically overthrown by a civil war in the 70s and died in captivity, probably at the hands of his captors. And it seemed to be a sort of a communist overthrow of the emperor. But he died in 1975. He didn't have his funeral until the year 2000. They sort of dug up his body from the compound or the prison where he
compound.
Was. Compound,
yeah. Yeah, that's good.
After
that out in Masonic bingo.
The post-communist government sort of eventually let people sort of dig up the body, and they had a sort of imperial style funeral, but it wasn't a state funeral thing. But Rita Marley, Bob Marley's wife, was involved at the funeral. Some Rastafarians refuse to believe he's dead and he's going to return again. I didn't read Iron Lion Zion is about him, the Bob Marley song. That's about Haile Selassie.
That makes sense.
I read about the area of Melanesia, which is between Polynesia and Micronesia, so it's sort of northeast off Australia, southeast off Papua New Guinea, so sort of Pacific Island regions. And I read about cargo cults. Do you know about cargo cults?
These are great.
Now, firstly, any listeners, cargo cult is not necessarily the most PC term. There's a lot of debate about whether you should be using the term in relation to this stuff. Basically,
because we've been very politically correct.
I know,
until now,
up to
so
now.
You won't wanna, yeah.
I just want to be very clear that I have done the reading. I know it might be offensive.
Because we've still got a lot of Micronesian and Melanesian listeners who've stayed on.
They're the only people we've got left apart from the atheists.
We are massive in the Solomon Islands. So a cargo cult is basically when these islands began to have first contact with Westerners, particularly in the 20th century when Western people arrived, vastly wealthy Western people arrive, airplanes and ships laden with goods. There's a belief in those cultures in this area. If you have a strong enough connection with your ancestors and with spiritual agents, it will lead to them rewarding you with lots of valuable items at some point in the future. And prestige in those societies was obtained by being wealthy enough to be able to give gifts to other people. So you'd be the big man. And so if you couldn't give people gifts, you were considered a rubbish man. And so when the Europeans arrived with all of these massive modern manufactured goods that could only possibly have been supplied by the ancestors, suddenly everyone felt like the rubbish man by comparison to the Europeans. So This especially boomed during World War II. Melanesia became a theatre of war, first with the Japanese and the Allies and the Americans. And a lot of these islands were inhabited or occupied by various groups of soldiers who would be airdropped loads of cans of food, or massive ships would arrive and dump stuff on the island, and occasionally these would be traded to the locals. And so when they left, it led to the mimicry of the behaviour of the people they had seen in an attempt to connect with the ancestors in the way that these Western people clearly were able to do. So you had locals body painting military insignia onto themselves. Oh, yeah. They would do parade ground drills with wooden rifles or salvaged rifles. They'd wear these wooden carved headphones while sitting in mock control towers trying to lure these airplanes back. They would wave landing signals and light fires and torches, and they even built life-size airplanes from straw and moved them out onto these landing strips that they'd created in an attempt to, you know, lure the ancestors back with all these gifts that they'd given to the white men.
This reminds me of, it's probably in the same part of the world where they have the Prince Philip cult.
That's exactly the right point. Yeah. I'm just about to talk about that, actually.
I see.
Funnily enough, the island of Tanna, in Vanuatu, they know Prince Philip as Man Belong Mrs. Queen.
There's a book about it.
Yes, it's called
Man Belong Mrs. Queen.
And basically, the cast on people of the Yao Nanan village in the island of Tanna, which is part of Vanuatu, they believe Prince Philip is a divine being because they have a story of a mountain spirit who travels over the seas to marry a powerful woman, and one day he'll return. And so they saw the respect afforded to the queen by their colonial overlords. And so she must be the powerful woman, and so her consort must be this mountain spirit who's going to return to us, being Prince Philip. So the royals visited Vanuatu in 1974, but I don't think they visited the island of Tanna. But Prince Philip was made aware of the cult and sent them a signed portrait of himself. And so the villagers were like, that's really nice, and we'll send them a present. So they sent back a club used for killing pigs.
I love that. What do you get for the man who has everything?
You get him a nal-nal, which is what this is called. And
of course
so, it is. And they requested that he would send them a photo of him posing with it, which he did. And in the year 2000, he sent them another photo. So they had these three photos of Prince Philip.
The Holy Ghost.
Is this Prince Philip sort of balancing out his racist reputation with incredible relations as being a god figure to this island in the Pacific and behaving in a good way?
He's basically C-3PO in
in Endor. There's one more cargo cult I want to talk about. It's the Johnson cult. So in 1964, the Lavangai people of New Hanover, Papua New and New Guinea, it was still two separate territories at the time. And New Guinea, they were trying to decide about who was going to rule the place. Australia was in control of it at the time and had been for about 20 years.
Should we call it New Guinea? Should we call it Papua New Guinea?
So they eventually decided they were going to have like elections and have an assembly and give them some sort of element of control. And the Lavangai people voted for President Lyndon Baines Johnson to be their representative in this assembly, even though he was not on the ballot. And they wanted him to represent them, and the outsiders saw this basically as, oh, they don't understand democracy, they don't understand the modern world, this is such a cargo cult, they've seen this big American figure, they think he should be in charge, they're idiots. An anthropologist, Dorothy Billings, she did some research into this, and apparently it's a piece of political theatre. So the Lavangai are used to sort of bluffs and embarrassing political opponents and sort of joking, and it's a big part of their culture. And Australia had taxed the island for basically 20 years while neglecting it, doing feck all about the ills. And they viewed America quite favourably because they provided aid during the war and it was a big prosperous nation. And so the election was imposed by Australia, and they saw it as a chance to give them a bloody nose by saying, we want to vote for this American guy because he'd be better at running this country than you are. Yeah. But my candidate for the title of the world's worst messiah is Moses of Crete. Have you read about Moses of Crete?
I did.
I'm delighted that you brought Moses of Crete up.
So some interpretations of the Talmud suggest that the Messiah might appear in the 5th century of the Common Era. Around this time, there was a man in Crete who appeared and said, I'm the Messiah, guys. It's definitely me. The year is right. He called himself Moses. He had the branding down. His real name might have been Fiscus. No one's entirely sure. And he said, basically, I'm going to lead you back. I'm going to do the Messiah thing. I'm going to take you back to the promised land.
I'm going to split the sea, aren't I?
I'm going to split the sea and lead you to Palestine. And so all his followers were like, all the Jews in Crete were like, this is the guy. It's happening, guys. Drop everything. Throw away your worldly goods. We're going to wait by the beach for the appointed day. And then this guy, Moses of Crete, appeared on a promontory above the sea and said, I will now part the sea. Start walking. It'll just part. I promise you. It doesn't matter. Just keep walking. Trust me. I will part the sea for you. And everyone just started walking into the sea, into the general direction of Palestine. And so many people drowned or were dashed on the rocks or carried away. And any who did survive and who turned around to go, what the fuck? He had already made a run for it.
Allegedly, one of the stories
I read. He disappeared, which shows you he was the Messiah.
All along. He'd been carried up into heaven.
Told you I'm incredulous.
Yeah. This is a real sign.
What I read in one of them is that he nicked all their possessions. Part of it was you don't need your... So he was an absolute con man. He said, you don't need your worldly goods, give them to me. I thought that he led the people off the promontory, and so some of them, in my head, it was like an ancient Greek game of lemmings, and all of his followers were dressed up in blue tops with green hair off into the sea.
Our candidates for the title of the world's worst Messiah today are Jan Bokkelsen, or John of Leiden, leader of the Anabaptists, and famed for, you know, golden throne and orgies.
Yep.
Jacob Frank, famed for orgies. Or Moses of Crete, drowner of the credulous.
Drowner of the credulous.
I'm sure that's how you'd like to be remembered.
His business card. Yeah. Moses of Crete, drowner of the credulous. Nice to meet you.
Yes. You two are very similar in the sense that it's sort of gather a big group of people and sort of try and milk them for as much as you can, for as long as you can, but come to a sticky end in the end of it all, prison or execution. Mm. Whereas I fucking hate Moses of Crete. He's terrible. Such a dickhead. Because he does the same thing, sets himself up as Jesus, but goes about it in such an underhand way. In the way of going, I'm going to perform this miracle. Just trust me, keep walking, it's fine. Literally leading from the back, leading people to their deaths. Yeah. Whereas the others were going like, we're all just going to have sex and I'm going to maybe get some money from you. And eventually it's all going to fall apart.
He's basically the Field Marshal Haig of messiahs. I'll stand here.
Yeah.
You guys walk into the danger.
Yeah.
I'm right behind you.
Whereas ours are like the Iggy Pop of messiahs.
Well, they very much set themselves up at the head of these things and were the figureheads of all them. Where he was figurehead, but as soon as possible could sneak away and get all the stuff that he needed. So I think I'm going to pick Moses of Crete as our world's worst messiah.
I fully endorse that.
I believe that L. Ron Hubbard once is on the record as saying, wouldn't it be cool if we started a religion, you could get so much stuff from people.
It may well have been. I mean, that seems to be the modus operandi.
Yeah, but you see, he should have been cleverer and not have mentioned that before starting a religion and getting lots of stuff from people.
Yeah, that's true.
So if I ever come out as the Messiah, I'm going to have this podcast destroyed.
Oh, I was about to say, if you ever come out as a Messiah, then this will be a holy text.
Yes.
And now you'll have to marry it. Good luck having sex with a podcast. Before we go, I've got some of the worst news of the week. This comes from CBSSports.com. The Bavarian Beer House in Glendale, Wisconsin is regretting more than most people the injury to Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Johnson. He's got a shoulder injury at the moment. And because they offer free beer to everyone in their bar on match day until the Packers score. And they say, basically, chances are we usually get to stop serving by halfway through the first quarter. That's roughly, they'll score a field goal or something will happen, and that's where the freebies end. Since Rodgers got injured, they failed to score in the first quarter of two of the four matches. And most recently, Sunday the 19th of November, that's the most recent game since we recorded this, they lost 23-0 to the Baltimore Ravens and had to spend the entire match serving free beer to their patrons. Yeah. Scott Bell, the general manager, explained in an interview that they gave away maybe 300 free beers. By the third quarter, people were apologising for taking their beer. Sam, what can people do if they want to find out more about you and your work? Where can they buy those cracking Bertrand Russell books?
Yeah. My book on Bertrand Russell and the Nature of Propositions is only $140.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so it's actually get maybe half a cent of that from each copy sold. A lot of my work is freely available to people with a library card.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. What's a library card?
No, like most of the journals I write, philosophy journals I write for, are like anybody with a university library card can find. One of the papers I'm most proud of, I wrote with my friend Tyron Goldschmidt. It's called "The Promise of a New Past." I wanted to call it "Why the Past Isn't What It Used to Be," but it's about whether the past is something that's changeable and whether it's rational to hope for a better past than the one we currently have. And
Guardian readers are going to be dry at home at the end of all these.
Now, that paper is free because it's on an open access journal.
Excellent.
Yes.
So if they just look up Sam Liebens, they'll find
Promise of a New
stuff.
Past. Well, they'll find me and a Dutch pop star. Because there was a young Dutch woman called Sam Liebens who was on the Dutch version of Pop Idol.
She sings about Bertrand Russell, I think.
Yeah. I am the only male Sam Liebens who comes up on Google towards the top.
Okay.
We're in touch, me and Sam.
Really?
Liebens, yeah.
Oh, lovely.
Because we're the only Sam Liebenses. It's like a Dave Gorman type thing.
Yeah. I once got in touch with the only other English-speaking Ben Vanderveld I could find is in New Zealand. So the world is going round with two opposite Ben Vandervelds.
Wow. You may never meet.
So what's the opposite of a comedian?
A comedian.
Shame.
I really hope he's a bad comedian. Yeah.
Anyway, meanwhile, we're all off to go jump in the sea, or at least these two are.
I'm going to watch from behind.
I'm going to mind your trousers and wallets.
You haven't gone far enough. Yeah. That's why.
Keep walking. Meanwhile, thank you for listening to Worsted Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hi guys, Barry here. Thank you very much for listening to Worst Foot Forward. I'm on my own today because Ben has had to cancel recording this outro. He's away at a gig. So you're stuck with me to wind up and say thank you very much, Sam, for doing the podcast with us. Do look up Sam's work online or in your local library if you're a student. He's a very learned and indeed very witty man. And we were delighted to have him on. He flew in all the way from Israel to record it with us, so thank you very much, Sam. What else? Please, as ever, give us a follow on Twitter at WorstFoot. Find us on Facebook, WorstFootForward, or send us an email to WorstFootForwardPodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow Ben and myself on Twitter. I'm on at BasmaxDay. Ben is on at Ben Vanderveld. Well, if the promise of a terrible messiah wasn't enough for you, we have a special Christmas episode coming out next week, Christmas Day itself. We are nothing if not optimistic. But at the end of the day, if you've had enough turkey and ham and you can't be arsed listening to the Queen's speech, or engaging with mildly racist relatives on topics as diverse as Brexit and Donald Trump, settle down and listen to us, joined by my good friend Alan Scott Douglas, an actor and professional Santa Claus, because we're going to talk about the world's worst Santa. Find out who's on our naughty list next week on Worst Foot Forward.